I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Now, this week on GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast, it's a very special pleasure to have Sunny Lindahl join us. He's an associate professor in political science at Østfold University College, Norway. He holds a PhD from the National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago in New Zealand. His main research interest is counterterrorism, and he is the author of A Critical Theory of Counterterrorism, Ontology, Epistemology, and Normativity. He's a regular commenter on issues of security and terrorism in Norway, and he is a fellow podcast host, and I had the pleasure of being on his podcast just a couple weeks ago. It's always fun to visit somebody else's studio. Sunny, welcome to GDP.
My pleasure.
And it was great to be on your podcast just a couple weeks ago. Would you be able to just give us a quick summary about what your podcast is all about, and maybe some of our listeners would want to tune in if they get the chance?
Well, yeah, I mean, a colleague, myself, we started a podcast almost 3 years ago now to give our students some sort of cursory curriculum or a different avenue or way into the curriculum. So when we talk about political science, it often gets very technical and very academic, as it should, but we thought, you know, maybe we can make a podcast where we talk about current affairs, but then try and sneak in political science or other kinds of theory and use that for students. So when we are talking about, for example, why is there a war in Ukraine, then, you know, we talk about that on the podcast using these different theories, highlighting them, and we thought maybe that's a good way for the students to engage with the theories and etc. And then it's sort of grown from that. So we have a lot more listeners now that are not students or academics, and then we do a few episodes in English and reach out to friends. And that's when I reached out to you when I saw that video of North Korea and the leader guiding that missile, and I thought I need to speak to Bob about this, and that's why we had you on. And I'm glad to say that episode is doing quite well in Norway.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I mean, watching the new North Korean missile video launch just shows that North Korea's got a real sound grasp of iMovie or whatever laptop-based movie editing software they've got a hold of now. But it was a pleasure to be on, and much like this podcast, same origin story. Started as a project dedicated to students in the classroom, and then we've expanded now to quite a global audience. So great to have you back and be part of that, Sunny. Mm. And yes, of course, we've known each other for some years now, going back to our pals at the University of Otago in New Zealand when we were both there on 2016, 2017. And as I do recall at the time, when you were doing your work with the National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at Otago, fantastic program, by the way, for potential students, you were deep into issues on counterterrorism. And this was, of course, well before the war in Ukraine, where we have not seen a conflict on this scale, one direct land invasion of one nation into another since the Second World War. Mm-hmm. But you continue to do work on counterterrorism. And what I want to ask you right now is what are you working on? And when it comes to counterterrorism, where are we with that? Is it still a priority in the world? And if so, how?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. You know, with the pandemic, the whole terrorism threat seemed to have disappeared, at least from the media. From the government, so there's still a lot of terrorism around. About 80% or somewhat 82% of all terrorism attacks occur in conflict zones or in war zones. So there are still a lot of terrorism going on in those areas. So you might suspect that at some point you'll see more of this in Ukraine, especially if this war drags on, especially because terrorism is a particularly useful tactic in that sense. But the stuff that I was working on when we met in Otago in New Zealand, and that I keep working on, has been to focus a lot on the war on terror, just because with President Bush launched this global war on terror in 2001. It's been about 21 years of this war on terror, and the war on terror has had profound effects on our societies. And how we view security threats and how we deal with certain security threats. It has created a different kind of environment in which we speak about immigrants and asylum seekers, for example. So they use this kind of framework when we're talking about people that are seeking asylum or seeking refugees in Europe and also in America. So it has had profound effects on our societies, and I'm not done with it, just simply because we're still messing up our counterterrorism efforts, plain and simple. So the thing is that when I started studying terrorism, that was right after the Breivik attacks in Norway in 2011, and I started doing my master's degree, and it was sort of kind of, very... In a way, random, but then we had this terrorist attack and I got interested in, and I started studying terrorism. And one of the things that I noticed quite early was that there's a lack of evaluation, there's a lack of empirical research on what works and what are we doing to combat and prevent terrorism. And that sort of got my interest. And so I started looking into it. And what I found was that and I'm not the only one saying this, but this is where at least one part of my research is that we've been doing counterterrorism so bad since 2001, and we basically helped create more terrorism, especially by invading Iraq. And so we created more terrorism, but we haven't really come to terms with how and why that happened. And so that's what I keep investigating. And that's also based on the wish to help us create a more humane, but also more successful counterterrorism, so that we can prevent terrorism, so that we can create community or help create communities, for example, in Syria and Iraq, where ISIS cannot recruit because people have possibilities of leading different lives, and they have those options. And sadly, we haven't really made too much progress in that. So I keep on researching counterterrorism in hope of making trying to create and inform a better counterterrorism approach. That work doesn't stop, and I suspect it won't stop for a while either, because we haven't, it's especially with the war in Ukraine, it's sort of
right.
Nobody talks about terrorism anymore, but it's still there. We're still spending enormous amounts of money on countering terrorism, which is a concept. Go figure.
You made some great points here. I mean, I found it suspicious when ISIS actually put out the call after COVID. It was like, okay, everybody, stay home from your regular terroristic activities because of the pandemic. I thought, okay, if these groups are calling it quits right now, this doesn't fully make sense. It seems like this would be a time to strike. But the other thing that you sort of touched on here is this paradigm, the global war on terror paradigm that Bush constructed, had to be one of the most simplistic and inaccurate narratives of what goes into the wickedly sociologically complex problem of terrorism. And, I go back to the Bush years. It was every day you'd wake up and the news headlines was about chasing somebody into some remote location. It was all about this reactionary approach to the issue. Mm-hmm. Not much about upstream, about issues like you meant about recruitment and trying to keep people from succumbing to the will and temptation of some of these groups.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that the if you know if I can try and boil it down, the problem is that in with the war on terror, it went from a thing, it went from countering a thing that many people do, you know, political violence. Terrorism is political violence, but with the war on terror, it went from being a thing that many people do, and then it changed to practically focusing on something that people are. You know, some people are terrorists and they need to be chased down and killed, and they are multiplying and we don't know where they are. And they may strike at any time. There was, you know, for many years on the DOD or NHS webpage, it's, you know, if you went on the webpage, it said terrorists can strike at virtually any time with any weapon. And it created that culture of fear. So it went from viewing terrorism as a tactic to identity, to this is, you know, some people are just terrorists and they're out there, we don't know where they are, and they're hell-bent on destroying us. And so the consequence of that is that the war was not focusing anymore on one specific organization and then how to counter it and prevent it, but it just, you know, so it wasn't just a war against, for example, the IRA, you know, that you had in Northern Ireland, where it's like, this is a group and this is a movement and it's sort of contained and it's like, we know what that group is. But then with the war on terror, it sort of broadened it out to become, you know, fighting this kind of identity, this concept. And the problem with that is that that war will never end, but it will certainly tie into other areas of our societies. And there's this, you know, great story from one of the leaders in the leader for the CIA at the time in his counterterrorism program, Kofor Black, and his wife once described in the book how Kofor Black would come home every evening, sit down in his chair with a cigar and a drink, close the curtains, and sink down in apocalyptic gloom, and that sort of describes that feeling, which is to say then that as you pointed out, it seems very simplistic, but in a culture of fear, fantasy can be a good substitute for the factual. Or the more realistic stuff. So, you know, and we're still dealing with that. And so, you know, it permeates counterterrorism. And so what I've been trying to do with my PhD and my work going forward is that I'm trying to help devise different counterterrorism. And I focused a lot on the political side on terrorism. So try to get us to cross the terrorism taboo, because terrorism is sort of surrounded by this taboo. You know, you can't really talk about it, and if you say that you can sort of understand where the, you know, a terrorist is coming from, for example, or you can understand what they were thinking, not excusing, but you can understand, like, this is the rationale, that's why the violence seems rational for them, and you're trying to investigate it, you know, that's very difficult to do. But I try to point out that most terrorism happens in political conflicts, and so we need to look at the political causes and trying to address those in order to try and prevent terrorism long term.
It's a great point. I mean, you know, there's so much we can get into on this, you know, about the cultural and religious stigma that was inflicted around the world, mostly at Muslim communities around the world during the war on terror. And the thing that's come from that, of course, is, you know, the use of the word in the United States, at least, is domestic terror.
Yeah.
Where there are those who are, you know, following these narratives and these stereotypes and lashing out in violent and irrational ways. But if you keep on this theory that you just put forward, that terrorism is born of political conflict, it would then seem that political conflict is also within some Western democracies, where we're seeing these actions, these terror actions take place, that have caused, you know, massive suffering from the U.S., Canada, for example. There was a terrible shooting in Quebec City, and then of course the case in New Zealand in Christchurch as well. I mean, is there something there that you can comment on with regards to that political conflict within Western democracies?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, it's, you raise a great point when in this whole discussion about domestic terrorism, which is so complex, and just, and also because it has tied into radicalization, mm-hmm. you know, so because when you had that sort of what is now known as homegrown terrorism, you start talking about homegrown terrorism. You know, you have these people that grew up in Canada or the Netherlands, Belgium, or Norway, and there's certain, and now they're, these people are perpetrating terrorist attacks, but they're on behalf of a terrorist group, ISIS, for example, or Al Qaeda, or for a cause in Syria, in Iraq, but they've never been there. They don't live there. They grew up in a different country, and a way to try and explain that. People start talking about radicalization, you know, as this process where you go from being nonviolent, maybe have some extreme attitudes or beliefs and opinions, to then perpetrating violence. And that is, you know, that's sort of the evolution of terrorism. So if you or counterterrorism. So if you go to conferences these days, and I certainly have these last couple of years on Zoom, you'll have a lot of terrorism scholars saying that, you know, terrorism is so, you know, that's passé, you know, that's gone, you know, and now it's all about radicalization. And radicalization is domestic, right? So, and then it's tied much more into those political conflicts, potential political conflicts that you mentioned. And that can take a lot of different ways. And in the West, you had the sort of identification, perhaps, of suspect cultures, communities, or groups of people feeling that they've been selected because of their skin color or religion or political beliefs. And so they've been talking about that kind of political conflict. And that radicalization debate is quite fascinating because it's trying to stop people from embracing quote unquote extreme ideas and then stopping them from turning to violence. But that is a very difficult process because you're trying to intervene before something ever happens. You know, you're trying to it's very preactive and preemptive, and so that's a very difficult discussion. And you see. In the UK, for example, they also tied critique of capitalism into this radicalization issues. And so if you are very critical against capitalism in universities, you might get flagged for some radical extreme ideas and beliefs. And I think that's one side of it, which is very fascinating. And it's very, it's far reaching into our communities in ways that a lot of people don't think about. And then you have the other side that I also focused a lot on, and that is the mere fact that with the invasion, for example, of Iraq, you had a lot of people in the West from, for example, Iraq and other areas that felt that they wanted to perpetrate violence towards Western targets as a response, as a protest against Western invasion of Iraq, and that is a clear political case. It doesn't excuse it, doesn't make it any better, but it tells us something about that, you know, the political nature of this conflict. So, you know, if we go about invading other countries, retaliatory attacks is something that you actually have to think about as a potential consequence. So, but there's right. there's no clear clear cause of terrorism, and there's no clear pathway, and it's quite complex. But now, as I said earlier, with the war in Ukraine, we barely talk about it.
So with the war in Ukraine, there's one angle that I've heard come up a couple times, and that's because the U.S. And many of its allies put so much into the global war on terror for the last how many years mm-hmm. that there wasn't the sort of focus that there probably needed to be on actually preparing for what Russia did. And so there's a bit of a scramble right now to sort of convince everybody that this, well, initially that it was happening, and now that weapons and supplies and resources and funds are getting to Ukraine and to resist this in the way that it's that's being carried out. I mean, is there any merit to that, that we're focusing on the complexities of global terror in a way that created distraction from what's actually going forward today?
Well, yeah, I think so. And there's, you know, it's hard to tell. We don't have those big studies, but you know, one case come to mind that might elucidate it somewhat or show a similar kind of problem, because they have tried to do evaluations within FBI, CIA, and in the military in the US, and you had those Afghanistan papers, right? That the I think the Washington Post published, where you had generals saying that, you know, we have no idea what we're doing in Afghanistan. You know, we were just spending a lot of resources and we don't really know what we're doing. And at the same time, you have statements from FBI, high-ranking FBI personnel saying that what we're doing with the war on terror is that we're only adding more hay to the haystack. You know, we can do this with normal police work. We don't need all those resources calming the earth for potential terrorists. We can sort this with police resources. Normal police work will do the job for the most part. So they felt like all this focus on terrorism was just adding more hate to the haystack, clouding the fields. Like they didn't really know. As like and they were kind of upset about you know, this this information overload, and that I might think goes into your question here. You know, have Western countries, for example, focused on terrorism and then forgot the bigger picture, or Russia, or other countries? And I think to some extent that is true, because it's been such a blind focus, if that's possible, it was a one-sided focus on terrorism, and we spent a lot of resources looking at a problem that doesn't really exist in the extent that would merit that response, right? So all those resources that we spent, that far outweighs the problem or the threat that terrorism is. But then everything is geared towards that, right? Because all the money has been going into fighting terrorism. So you have what we now call the terrorism industry, you know, a lot of companies and et cetera, making money on combating terrorism. So all the focus has been towards terrorism, which again is a concept and it's very elusive, and you will always find new terrorists. So you have that focus everywhere, and in that sense, I think I definitely think that the focus has, you know, it's been too one-sided, and they've forgotten the more maybe mundane political conflicts. But then in that sense, I think there's another oversight maybe, and this is a contentious discussion. But then that's you know, the role of NATO. And NATO also played a sort of role in combating terrorism, which is not really NATO's task. So with the war in Ukraine, NATO is sort of like back in their wheelhouse, right? This is what NATO does. So I guess NATO is really happy in a way. You know, they're not happy, but you know, this is what they were meant to do because Russia's back. In the same way, and I think maybe this is an interesting discussion, when it came to terrorism and invading Iraq, it seems like nobody asked the questions about, okay, what will our actions do? What consequences can they create? And I think maybe in certain ways that NATO has operated, I think maybe they've been blind to what that might bring about in Russia and Putin. And maybe fail to take the necessary steps in that regard. So I don't think they fully understood the consequences of those actions. And that is not to say that NATO is to blame for the war in Russia. That's not what I'm saying. But it's that mechanism where you understand that what you're doing will have consequences when it comes to the war on terror, but also when it comes to dealing with big states like Russia.
Right. So, Sonny, last question for you here, and this is me asking to get your crystal ball out a little bit. But knowing what we've known from the state of terror groups before the pandemic, and now with the disruption to all things in the global economy as a result of this war in Ukraine, and just the civil disruption that war brings to the region. What do you feel we can expect to have to deal with when it comes to terrorism? And I guess the heart of the question is this: what should counterterrorism look like going forward, realizing that this war in Ukraine is very much a present factor?
Given that about 80% of all terrorist attacks occur in political conflicts, I think as long as we have political conflicts, we will also see more terrorism. And that's an important takeaway, an important point of departure, right? Because if you recognize the political conflict, then counterterrorism should be more like basically conflict resolution and peace building, right? Trying to build, go into those, help those communities become more resilient and create a peaceful society. And that can look, that can take many different shapes. There's not a blueprint for creating that. But I think the point of departure should then be, those political conflicts. The problem that I see here is also that with the war in Ukraine, but also the pandemic, you see a cooling down of the economy. And we also have global warming. Let's not forget the biggest security threat that we're currently facing, right? So you have those factors coming in, and you have some factors: a cooling economy, global warming, a lot of political tensions in many parts of the world, and that is a good recipe for political conflict and also terrorism. Because terrorism, as I said, usually belongs to that, to political conflict. So I think we'll see more terrorism if those conflicts are allowed to escalate and we're not dealing with it. So what I would like to see is that I really would like us to not continue the war on terror, and I would like us to not respond to terrorism with more violence. That we're not trying to just mirror the terrorists by killing more people, because when you're doing it, and we see it now in Ukraine as well, when you're using violence and you go into those areas, you're not targeting just military personnel or terrorists. You're killing a lot of innocent civilians as well, and the families. And then you have this violence. The way I look at it is a phenomenon with a history of violence and counter-violence. And so I think if counter-terrorism, if we keep on doing the war on terror by responding first with violence and then trying to repair it, I think we're just going to make terrorism into a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we need to come to terms with, that illusion of what I call good violence, and just realize that violence needs to be absolutely the last resort, and we need to be much more creative about how we go about countering, but also especially preventing terrorism. And I think that goes through better peace diplomacy, peace building, conflict resolution, those all the tools that we have in the toolbox, and that we use those mechanisms, because that will in turn help create societies that will be more resistant to recruitment, and they will, when people have lives to live and when they have dreams and futures that they can sort of chase, terrorism is not very attractive. So we need to create that reality for more people. So we need to have a much more holistic counterterrorism and take it out of this narrow-minded and one-sided focus on killing and detaining terrorists, etc., and bombing people. We've been trying to bomb people to become peaceful, and so we need to stop that. But looking into the glass bowl, I think global warming, unfortunately, will create more political conflict, and that will create more terrorism. And that's where I think we really need to understand the political nature when that happens.
Well, Sonny Lindholm from the Political Science Department at Østfold University College in Norway. That is a sober reminder of what may be very much part of the political landscape for the years to come with these challenges in the background. And on that, I do want to thank you for joining us on GDP today and for taking the time also to have me over your way on your podcast on political science. It's been a pleasure, and thanks very much for sharing your perspective today.
Good to be with you.